people's analysis and make myself comfortable.
I used to teach English at the University of Hull, and before I, hence partly the Larkin connection, I suppose, and before I went there, I wrote my thesis at the University of Oxford, where I'd done my first degree, and the book of poems that I wrote while I was there, partly as a student and partly as a postgraduate student, was called Obligacy, and that came out in 78. And then I went almost immediately off to teaching Hull. In fact, the book came out just after I got to Hull. And as anybody who's been in this situation will have found themselves, I found myself very busy, and so busy that I stopped writing really for 3 years. I wrote, you know, 3 poems when I was in Hull, and then after that I thought that I would spend the rest of my life complaining about not having written anything unless I resigned. So I resigned. And about 3 months later, everybody started getting voluntary redundancy money. I've handled my career a bit better, I would have. And went back to where I hadn't sold my house and started writing again. And then almost immediately went off to India, where I didn't write anything while I was there, but I did write something quite long when I got back. And what I shall say a bit more about in a moment. And the shorter poems that I wrote between the British Demons and now are coming out next year. And this is really the poems that I want to start by reading. The book's going to be called Secret Narratives. I did once write a poem called Secret Narratives, though it went the way of bones, and I did keep a bit on it. But the first poem in the book is called Open Secrets, which is part of a series of 3 or 4 poems at the start of the book about the creation of character and about writing narrative poems, which I'm interested in doing. And it's a 3-verse poem, and the first 2 verses are set in the voice of some other speaker, and it's set in, spoken about Scotland. And the 3rd verse is spoken by someone else, a me, an I figure. Open Secrets. The first time Father erupted that day was at Florey, rolling the dustbins downhill to their emptying pit. From the upstairs landing, I saw him, arms crossed, with his dressing gown's dark green paisley swirled in the wind, and Florey scarlet, still half swiveled round to the litter as if it surprised her, tattering out in a trail of scrumpled tissues and newspaper onto the moor. After dark, in McDermott's barn at the usual time, she told me his other disaster, how he had taken 5 shots that day to finish his stag, and the 5th was fired by McDermott. McDermott went with him as gilly, and afterwards had the stag to himself for keeping quiet. If ever Florey stopped talking, we heard it next door through the pine-board wall, dribbling and pinging blood in a metal bucket. Just now, prolonging my journey home to you, I killed an hour where my road lay over a moor and made this up. Florey, I sat on a grass-grown, crumbling stack of peat with the boy by her side, and as soon as she whispered, "Come on, we've done it before," I made him imagine his father garrotting the stag, slitting the stomach and sliding his hands inside for warmth. He was never myself, this boy, but I know if I tell you his story, you'll think we are one and the same, both of us hiding in fictions which say what we cannot admit to ourselves. Under pressure of the nicest sort, I feel I ought to read this next poem, which is achieved a degree of notoriety about 18 months ago that I never envisaged. Or just after I left Hull, the Arvon organisation had a competition. And if you've just given up your job and somebody's offering £5,000 for a poem, you think, I will go in for it. And when you win it, you feel very lucky. But everybody else thinks that you deserve it, so they write you hate letters.
And I mean, the really kind of lasting thing which this did for me was to have lorry loads of hate mail turn up outside my house every day for a long time. And deeply unpleasant. It was just after Lennon got shot, and I was convinced that I was the next person to die. Anyway, the situation in this poem is the poem is being remembered by a woman of about 50 or 60 old, and she's remembering being a girl in the Second World War, a girl who has just received her first love letter. And in order to get away from her inquisitive brother, who is about to enlist, the girl takes the letter out into the countryside to read it privately, and there walks into what is in fact a memory that my mother deposited with me of seeing a German fighter plane flying very low and close over the landscape, and later hearing that the pilot had bailed out, and for a reason that he knew, his parachute hadn't opened and he'd been killed. And this idea had been, I mean, the single idea that the pilot had been drifting around in my mind for some time, and I didn't feel that I'd had enough to make of it, really, until I had the idea of, or the notion of her just having had this love letter. And the point, really, that I was after is that everything, as soon as she's had the letter, everything becomes part of her kind of erotic interest. So it's called the letter. If I remember right, his first letter, found where? My side plate, perhaps? Or propped on our heavy brown teapot? One thing is clear, my brother, leaning across, asking, who is he? Half angry, as always, that summer before enlistment. Then, alone in the sunlit yard, mother unlocking a door to call, up so early, waving her yellow duster goodbye in a small, sinking cloud. The gate creaks shut, and there in the lane I'm running uphill, vanishing where the woodland starts. The ash ground, a solid contour swept through ripening wheat, and a fringe of stippled green shading the furrow. Now I am hardly breathing, gripping the thin paper and reading, write to me please, I miss you, my angel. Almost shocked, but repeating him line by line, and watching the words jitter under the pale, spidery shadows of leaves. How else did I leave the plane unheard so long? But suddenly there it was, a Messerschmitt low at the wood's edge. What I see today is the window open, the pilot's unguarded face somehow closer than possible. Goggles pushed up, a stripe of ginger moustache, and his eyes fixed on my own while I stand with the letter held out, my frock blowing, before I am lost in cover again, heading for home. He must have banked at once, climbing steeply until his jump and watching our simple village below, the downs swelling and flattening, speckled with farms and bushy chalk pits. By lunch, they found where he lay, the parachute tight in its pack and both hands spread as if they could break the fall. I still imagine him there, exactly, his face pressed close to the sweet-smelling grass, his legs splayed wide in a candid, unshameable V. In a way, I suppose that poem's about writing too, and the next one certainly is, as was the first one meant to be. When I travel in the car, I channel hop as on the radio, as I think you do too. And not all that long ago, I landed on a report that the journalist James Cameron gave about a visit he'd made several years ago to visit Albert Schweitzer in Schweitzer's leper hospital in the middle of Africa. And the brief that Cameron had was to write about Schweitzer as this great kind of hero who'd done what nobody else had managed to do for a particularly benighted part of the world. But that when Cameron got there, he found that the hospital was run along very eccentric lines, and Schweitzer's respect for life was, for organic life of all kinds, was such that it prevented him from using medicines in the creation of which organic life had been killed. So he wasn't using all the medicines, all the kind of modern best medicines that he might have been able to use. But that when Cameron came home, he felt that he wasn't able to blow the cover on Schweitzer as he wanted to do, because the legend in itself had some kind of value. And this seemed an interesting predicament for somebody to be in. So I wrote a poem about it. Though I have taken a lot of liberties with Schweitzer, as you will see, and also with Cameron. And the poem's called The Great Man. If you're writing a poem about that part of the world, it's a bit hard not to think of comrades, so you have to get that out of the way early on, which I do. The Great Man. It was straight out of Comrade, but true. At midday, I rounded the umpteenth turn of the river, and there was the man himself, surprised in the hospital yard. Just as I thought, he was all I had never expected. Far older, no sign of the famous moustache, and the walk a frightened scamper towards the jungle, one hand cramming a yellow hat hard down. He returned and was smiling, of course, for the evening meal. You are a journalist? Wonderful, wonderful, yes, and have taken a week to be with us or get here. Never you worry, someone will show you the hospital soon. He is a pride and joy. If it were now, I could not remember the clammy weight of his hand on my shoulder more clearly, half welcoming, half for support, or the way his eyes were scanning my face, but staring at someone else. Whoever it was appeared again when he played, which was done like a maestro, theatrical strides to the dais when supper was over, and servants dragging his masterpiece centre stage. A rickety, straight-up, knee-hole bamboo organ. I knew about this. I had read in the books how natives would gratefully leave their hearths and listen enchanted for hours. But I never imagined he might have performed like a drain. He was flat for most of the fugue, steadfastly fixing his gaze on the someone or something I could not see. Then the rain drowned him, beginning at sunset like clockwork, and sullenly pounding the metal roof. It never let up until morning. Lying in bed, I could follow a handful of patients prowling their ward from window to window, glistening torsos and heads as long as the power held out, and afterwards abstract blurs. But just to be there was a cure, everyone knew. Wasn't the doctor so gentle he even avoided the ant which crossed his path? How much he did for the dying, I would find out. Tagging along on his rounds with my camera poised. Master, master, you are a god to us. That was the woman we found next day in the yard, the first of dozens. She drew back the shawl from her raspberry shoulders with almost a smile, but the doctor was shaking his head. He prayed, which he always did, then ordered a poultice of warm riverbank mud to be bound on her skin. If I had said he was fake, who would have listened? I was a stranger, and strangers were not to be trusted. Do nothing, was all I could think. When you are home, then say whatever you like. Well, here I am home today, with my notebook and photographs spread on my desk, and the rain which has blanketed London this morning, creasing my window. Its whisper is scarcely a sound, but it softens the stop-go scratching my pencil nibs. He must have been 80 by then, but the moment our ramshackle steamer nosed in by the jetty, there he was striding to greet us, crushing my hand in his grip. I know that what's going to happen now is that it sounds like I spend the entire time going around the world in aeroplanes, which is not, alas, true. But there are a couple of, as I was saying, a supper being abroad always makes me write. I suppose partly because it puts you in that situation of seeing the familiar world strangely, which is what the situation I was trying to get into all the time as a writer, at least I find myself doing so. And several years ago, I went to Amsterdam And when I was there, as I expect many of you have done too, I went to see Anne Frank's house. And rather in spite of myself, because I felt that whatever I had to say about it would fall short of what I felt about it, and also because I realised it was somewhere that a lot of people were likely to have written about, I felt rather disinclined to write about it, but in spite of myself, I did. And what interested me and moved me about seeing the house is that, which is preserved as a kind of museum to Anne Frank and to the Jews who died in the Second World War generally, was the feeling that she didn't want to grow up to be a star, but just wanted to grow up to be like us and lead an ordinary life. And the various relics of those which are left around the house are there, so as I hope you'll see. And the poem is called Anne Frank Rees. Even now, after twice her lifetime of grief and anger in the very place, whoever comes to climb these narrow stairs discovers how the bookcase slides aside, then walks through shadow into sunlit rooms, can never help but break her secrecy again. Just listening is a kind of guilt. The Westerkirk repeats itself outside, as if all time worked round towards her fear and made each stroke die down on guarded streets. Imagine it. 3 years of whispering and loneliness and plotting day by day the Allied line in Europe with a yellow chalk. What hope she had for ordinary love and interest survives her here, displayed above the bed as pictures of her family, some actors, fashions chosen by Princess Elizabeth. And those who stoop to see them find not only patience missing its reward, but one enduring wish for chances like my own, to leave as simply as I do, and walk at ease up dusty tree-lined avenues, or watch a silent barge come clear of bridges, settling their reflections in the blue canal. This is another poem I wrote about being somewhere else, which was, in this case, being in New York. And although New York is actually very easy to find your way around, I kept getting lost. The way I found my way home was to align myself on the grid with a walk, don't walk sign, one of those street crossing signs, which had been hit by a cab or something. Maybe the cab in the poem anyway. It had been hit so hard that the walk, don't walk sign came on upside down. In that kind of peremptory way of American culture, it's like getting down America being on top of the cabs. And I say that really only because in the first line of the poem, Don't Walk is printed upside down, which you wouldn't really realise unless you saw it on the page. And because I, much as I enjoyed being there, I also felt quite scared a lot of the time, and I wanted to write about the feeling of being scared. So in order to try and suggest it, at least to myself anyway, I made up a story about an ex-draft dodgy dope fiend called Joey, who I don't know. And the poem's called West 23rd. Where the cab smashed it, don't walk is my marker. West 23rd and a block to Joey's apartment. The manholes spurting their usual sprays of steam. I stride them down, blind in each cloud, then myself, then blind again. And first thing back, I phone you, the quick trampolining bring, bring, bouncing me thousands of miles to your desk, your bedside, wherever I catch you. Only a fortnight now, your speech is slow, as if filtered through water. Come soon. Joey thinks he is passing the time for me, asking me nightcap, wiping the kitchen table clean with his inside cuff, and trickling two steady tracks of cocaine. Me first, or did I go first last night? If he speaks at all after this, what he says is the same. I never fought, but I tell you, it fucked me up. I hid 3 years. I even tried faking my death, and it must have worked. Those others, who went, they're fucked up too, but more. Now I'm free, and I never killed anyone. Mm-hmm. Ask around. Not a single one. I make my excuses early, and lie on my unmade bed, telling myself I might see you, or hear your voice, in the rain of luminous atoms streaking the air. But you never appear. When the atoms subside at last, it is only for traffic, the hiss of its surf all night, and Joey padding the corridor barefoot just before sleep, some almost forgotten instinct reminding him, bolt the door. When my grandfather died, who, and I hardly knew him, he left me his desk, and in one drawer of it had been put by some kindly executor his photograph album. And although this is the kind of thing which has no particular interest to anybody other than immediate family, it does have interest to immediate family, or at least did in my case, and particularly a group of photographs which he'd had taken of himself and other people in Egypt during the First World War, where he ended up, and was obviously not meant to. It was obviously meant to be in Gallipoli or somewhere where he'd almost certainly been killed, but for a reason I don't fully understand, is they've got rerouted to Egypt. And there are a lot of photographs of him on the arm of very sexy looking bathing girls, and obviously having a guilty good time. And one of the few things that I can remember him saying about this period in his life is that, and this explains something in the poem, which is the reason I'm saying it, is that regardless of what English officers' actual names were, the bathing girls referred to them all as Captain Mackenzie, presumably in memory of some hyperactive Captain Mackenzie of earlier days. And this seemed like too good a trick to miss. And the other thing that appealed to me about the situation was that I'm very keen on Tennyson's poems, and I was pleased to find out when I went off to look in a copy of the newspaper, The Times, for what was going on in Egypt at this period. I went off to see what he might have been doing, and I found an account of a very peculiar military action which he's described in the poem. But I also found that the part of Egypt in which he was, which is called Glimenopolo, was in a district called Lotophagi, because in ancient times the lotus eaters were supposed to live there. And if he's a cavalry officer, which he was, then it seemed that there was kind of another thing one might say about Tennyson somewhere along the way, as well as thinking about the lotus eaters. And I think that probably explains all the bits and pieces that need to be explained in the poem, which is called Bathing at Glimenopolo, and is spoken, as you would have gathered, by an English cavalry officer in Egypt in 1915. Bathing at Glimenopolo. Lotophagi, I can believe it. First moment ashore, the heat stunned us, a lavish blast and the stink of horses. Then it was Mr. Captain Mackenzie. Bathing girls ran from the beach, white towels and parasols weaving through gun carriages, crates and saddlery lined on the quay to pelt us with flowers. Want Captain Mackenzie? I give you good times. But we rode away, eyes front and smiling, pursued until the majestic hotel gates. Men to the grands, officers one to a cool high-ceilinged room, mine with a balcony looking down to the lake. There were pelicans clambering carefully in and out and in, never still, wrecking the stagnant calm, fighting and shaking their throats with a flabby rattle. Otherwise, peace. The cedar layered in enormous green-black slabs and shading tents on the lawn. The horses, only a rumour, stamping and snorting out by the kitchen garden. Each morning we rode early to Christmas Hill, 2 hours of dressage in dusty circuits, then home with the sun still low. For the rest, time was our own. No orders, no news from France, but delicious boredom. Polo some evenings, and long afternoons, bathing at Glimenopolo. Eras, I have you by heart, giggling and stumbling up from the breakers into my photograph. One thin hand pressed to your cheek, your knee-length navy blue costume puckered and clinging. I singled you out day after day after day to swim with, to dawdle arm in arm on the beach as the furious sun sank, and later to hear your pigeon whispers dancing in waterfront cafes. You not like anyone, gentling than other Captain Mackenzie's. You not like others. Your lemon-smelling hair loose and brushing my mouth, your bracelets clinking, and languorous slow waltzes twirling us round and round in the smoky half-light. Luck, I kept telling myself, luck, it will end. But the lazy days stretched into months, and then we were riding out on a clear pastel blue morning to Christmas Hill as ever. And halfway at Carlier, stopped at our watering place, a date grove fringing the pool, and the whole platoon fanned in a crescent to drink. I was dismounted, leading my horse over packed sand, empty-headed and waving flies from my face when the firing began. 10 shots, perhaps, flips and smacks into date trunks or puffing the sand, and nobody heard. But we charged, all of us thinking, at last, action at last, as our clumsy light brigade wheeled under the trees and away up a steady slope. I was far left, drawing my sword with a stupid, high-pitched yelp as we labored through silvery mirage lakes. They were waiting ahead, Senusai no more than a dozen, their gypsy silhouettes crouching and slinking back into stones as we breasted the rise. The end of the world. A sheer wall falling hundreds of feet to a haze of yellow scrub. I wrenched myself round, sword dropped, head low, to a dead, teetering halt as our line staggered and buckled and broke in a clattering slide. I can hear it again, the panicking whinnies, shouts, and the rush of scree where they shambled off into space. It has taken 3 days to bury them, one for the trek to the valley floor, one to scratch their ranks of graves, one to return. There is little the same. At 6 we have curfew now. I am writing this after dark on my knee in the school of instruction grounds in a tent. I cannot sleep. Sirens disturb me, groaning up from the harbour. Those are the ships from Gallipoli, unloading their trail of stretchers to the Majestic, where you will be waiting, Eros, I know. Stopped outside the gates, high-heeled just as you were, with your hair fluffed out after swimming, repeating your tender, sluttish call. Want Captain Mackenzie? I give you good times.
If you do write narrative poems, then the chances are that you will get interested in writing longer ones, I think. And I know that saying that is something which makes people's hearts sink. Really. I mean, I remember going to readings, I've often been to readings myself where people say, I've got interested in writing longer poems, and oh Christ. But I think that when you write them, you ought to be under a special obligation to realise that whoever's going to have to read them or listen to them has got an enormous prejudice against long poems to deal with. And this puts you, again, under an obligation to vary pace and, in my view, at least for my own purposes, keep a strong narrative interest going, tell a story. And one of the things that one of the feelings I wanted to provoke in the poem that I'm going to read, which is the Will of Galilee's Long, is that kind of pleasure which I, anyway, remember having when I was a child, being read to, just liking being told a story very much. And there's a special difficulty about reading this poem in the same room as people who are themselves Indian, because the poem is set in India, and it is not really a very Indian poem. It's a very
European poem. It's all I felt competent to write, so don't feel like I had to do anything else. And of course, if you do that, you're very conscious of a whole load of other European accounts of India, somehow or other, from Kipling through to J.G. Farrell and the United Nations, and Paul Scott and so on. And it's very much with that that my poem seeks to align itself, I suppose, rather than with, say, Midnight's Children, which is a very Indian book. And the story is this. It's, the poem is spoken by a European male of about 30-odd who remembers a time in India which takes up most of the poem, which is set during the, or a bit of his own history, which is the name of the poem, which is set during the independence period. The poem's called Independence. And what happens is this. At the beginning of the poem, he's working for an Indian-owned engineering company in about 45 or thereabouts, and as partition and independence come closer, his Indian-owned engineering company decide that they want to get rid of him and be pure, run by Indians, for Indians, and so on. So they encourage him to go, and he climbs into his ramshackle car and drives further south in India and ends up applying for and getting a job in a European-owned copy factory, which is actually the copy factory that I stayed in when I was in India 18 months or so ago. My wife was born in India, which is where my copy comes from. It's all her family history, being all her family's dirty laundry being washed in public. When he gets there, he falls in love with the daughter of the person who owns the copy factory, and after a kind of ex-certificate section, they get married. And the father then decides, by now the father-in-law, decides to come back to England and leave the factory in charge of his son-in-law, the speaker of the poem, which he does. And when he's gone, and after independence has been declared, everything starts to go wrong. The wife dies having the baby. The factory floods, which actually it does. As no doubt you have other things you could have bring to bear on it. And it does flood every year into the family, but actually what happens is that they just build it up again, and then it floods again at the end of the year. But this is a kind of terminal washout in the poem. And he also starts, and this is where I wanted the poem to be political, to feel ill at ease in a culture which isn't his and which he feels he has no rights in and he has no right to interfere with. So for those kind of public and private reasons, he comes back to England at the end of the poem. And actually the poem opens and closes in England in his father's house, which I imagine to be somewhere like Eastbourne, on some south coast kind of retirement town, where he's only staying temporarily, but what happens to him after that, I don't know. So the first and last section of the poem, which is in sections of this, first and last are set in England, and all the middle bit is set in India. And as I say, it's called Independence. A month home, and awake at three, expecting light. Still half the world in darkness to roll away, but here I am by the window, stooping, quickly smearing a hole in its misted, silvery glass. Your father's house, his view of sand dunes stubbled with grass, and the sea heavily sliding, its craters split and slammed shut to the moon. As I look, wind staggers the garden lilac, then races off, distressing the whole front. The neighbor's gate squeaking and banging, the pub sign knocking its frame once, twice, and silent. But who is awake? I glance at my bed and the sheet thrown back, a crumpled ghost where I slept, on the right, as we did together. And there, with no more than the thought, I turn to the window again and imagine you walking towards me in silence, bringing the friends, the lost company, the servants I left, everyone bowed and shawled as though it were dawn, and this wavering grey moonlight, the dust they had churned into early mist. It was dawn when my journey finished at last. 3 days, 3 nights stop go in my rickety Austin, a terrified slow sweep from the Punjab down past Delhi, Agra, Kanpur to reach Kamaria. Jumbled roofs and the sun just clear into perfect blue. I drove along sleeping streets, unshaven, still scared. But no sign of the riots, just slogans splashed and dribbling. Partition, no to partition, quit India. What of my home? Would it be looted by then, or what? The manager's voice came back to me over and over, blustering, "Now we are free, no Britishers, now you must go." But smiling, shaking my hand. Then I was home, and my servant ran to greet me, whispering, "Go, Saab, it is dangerous, go." All I could save was with me. One suitcase, Shakespeare, a China mug, and the Hindustan Times, 3 days old. I can see it now, your father's advertisement circled with red ink, his name the friend of a friend of a friend. In a week, when I stood in his narrow hall for my interview, early, rehearsing my lines, you were there. A sudden, unthinking, surprised rush from your room, from a shower, your hair darkened with water and plastered down, your feet bare, and one hand pulling the throat of your dressing gown close, hiding the quick, freckled blush I saw beginning and deepening there like a burn. So it began, our first blue midwinter. Each cavernous, cloudless morning, I drove to the godown at 6, stock taking wool for an hour. Indigo, crimson, natural, gold. Then away round the villages. Yes, I am new. Yes, namaste. The carpet, Saab. Carpets, and trained as an engineer. House by house, I ducked and entered those close mud rooms. The silence is there. Fathers and sons on their worn logs, smiling through taut bars of string. The twang and rustle of wool, and the patterns rising. Finish how soon? More smiles, the waggling side-to-side headshake, goodbye. And as evening approached, I circled back to my bungalow. Would you be there? If I came from Mirsapur, east, it was over the high Ganges bridge. I would stop midway, and leaning warily out from the delicate parapet, whisper your name. Let her love me. If not, let me not be found out. Let her father like me. I waited a moment, gazing down in the twilight, then crumpled a single rupee note and dropped it, straining to watch, but never seeing the fall to its end on the river's dark, sluggish green. It was our first time. We had shuffled and clutched at club dances, and once after tennis I kissed you, my hand finding the warm small of your back, brushing its damp, soft hackle of hair. Then it was midnight, and over the wall I dropped down to the hushed Macfarlane garden, your nervous, adoring commando, crashing and farcical. Which was your room? Third right in your letter? Oh, please, please come soon. I've been well for at least 10 days. My appendix is snug in its jar on the windowsill, staring me out. Your shutter unstuck with a parched squeak. Is it you? Yes. I kissed you again, missing your mouth. Shh! The deliberate, firm tap-tapping of footsteps outside. Nurse, quick, in there! And I dragged the heavy, tallboy door shut behind me. Your voices were hushed. No, nothing, thank you, nothing. I'm fine. Good night. But I waited. Your nightdresses hanging close to my face, silky and smelling of talc. Then I was out. Shoes off, you said. That's all. And I eased myself down on your narrow bed. Careful, my stitches. Lie still. Still as you can. Like this. On your back. And so you unbuttoned me, gingerly kneeling astride. And then with that gradual, quickening dip and rise, you tipped evenly backwards and forwards as if you were riding drunk, dissolving the bed, the tall boy, the room, the dark coat I ripped on the wall when I scrambled home, but war unmended for days as our secret sign. Courting all that spring to independence, spring and into the heat, shimmering days I hurried to end for you. Each late afternoon we were side by side at your father's bungalow, longing for sunset, the punkah lightly weighing us down with its soft rush of air. He smiled, "Really, you too, go on, supper's not yet." And we were away, hand in hand on the Austin's cracked back seat, all windows down, the driver's face staring ahead in the mirror. They were perfect, those cool evening drives, the sun bleary with dust, white eucalyptus avenues, tiny flickering fires, and the sweet wood smoke rising. "When will you marry me?" "Soon?" When you said it lazily, breathing warm in my ear, on that potholed road out beyond Mirsapur. "Soon?" We were late, with the engine off at the crossing, a slender pole waist high, and heat still bouncing up from the rails, warping the air. The keeper emerged from his shack, half lifted the pole, listened, then slammed it back. Up, down, you said, blushing, and chafed my hand. We waited in silence, hearing the train's deep, flustering chomp, chomp, closer and closer, a shrieking whistle, and there it was, Benares, Lahore on chipped plates, windows barred, and the packed, vanishing faces of refugees. Married in Independence Week, the factory shut, and the church packed with the carpet wallers who caught us up in their holiday. "Now we are free," they were shouting, "free," roping our necks with garlands of roses and ganders. That night, before taking our honeymoon journey north to the hills, we were secret in Mirsapur's ramshackle best hotel, strolling late round the pool. A 3-foot scummy drop to the water, its glassy length steady and speckled with insects performing their tiny dance, with the last swimmer long gone. "I love you. Look at us, husband and wife." You pointed down at our faces, stared and turned inside. "Come on," leaving your hand still grasped in mine as we reached for the key and the snub black light switch. Then you were screaming, "Let go!" A furious quick sizzle, "Let go! Let go!" And I did, with a sticky tear of skin. We were driving at once, my good right hand tight on the wheel, your left stretched over, changing the gears to McFarlane. "Back here," you said it, teeth clenched, as we stood in the dark porch side by side for a moment, our hands stretched clear in front. You nodded towards them. "Symbols?" "Symbols, balls," I said, and smiled, leading you in. "Nurse, hello, are you there?" A month alone, but stirring, slowly, making room in our lives for news outside ourselves. Spring brought the heat again, day after day in my office, the papers built rustling under their weights, shaken and plucked as the punkah whipped round in its clammy rush. On my wall, I had pinned the first free replacement map. India, Pakistan, the new word jagged up through the Indus Valley to end in the mountain's lumpy bruise. When Gandhi died, your father traced the frontier down, saying, "Now, now we shall see," and bowed his head, suddenly homesick for England. Next day, he was round the villages talking, cajoling, then back at my desk, empty-handed. "It's grief," he said. "They won't do anything. You understand." He stared at my map and sighed, imagining high white cliffs and gantries clearing through mist, a dockside glossy with early rain. With your father gone, and his furniture gone or stacked in the go-down waiting, the house was ours. Tall, whitewashed rooms and the spaces he left, dents in a carpet, for chairs, the crushed square of a cupboard. "Take care," he said, with his brave face in the cabin doorway. "Remember, as soon as the baby comes, write, soon as you can. Now, please." But we stayed all morning, staring up from the quay, scanning those high rails for his wave and seeing nothing. Then nothing again when he sailed, the liner unthinkably huge as they tugged it clear, but suddenly tiny, a slow dispersing feather of smoke spiraling north. We imagined it fading for days, free with ourselves to ourselves at last. Each night was our tender, private game. Listen, what can you hear? You would be lying back with your dress pulled up, holding my head side on to your stomach. Anything? Yes, I craned for the child's gurgle. Yes, a boxer, that or a football player. We slept outside that summer, two wide-eyed effigies hand in hand on the cool veranda, our hearts racing, watching the stars blaze and swing away through our nets. 5 months, six, and then for a week, my trip alone to Delhi on business. Should you have come? Was that it? Even in summer? I travel the last few miles of the journey back endlessly. There is the taxi again, almost home from the station. And there am I, with the windows wound right down, so my eyes run, blurring the house and the one servant who met me. Where is the memsahib? My question returns off dazzling white walls. "Saab," he says, in a deep, widening silence. I remember cicadas, their manic bowing, and sun crashing up from the yard. Then his voice breaks. "Oh, Saab," and he turns towards me, weeping. But I am refusing to understand, not moving, grinning, thinking of nothing, and letting the same unbidden phrase occur to me, over and over. "Saab," he says it again, "I show you now. Humpty tumpty gir gir pat. Humpty tumpty gir gir pat." A scar of yellow clods, the scratch mark of something vanished, a dry scuffle. "You will wake up," I was thinking. "Wake up!" Crouched with my head tilted sideways, as if I might just make out your voice. "Saab?" It was the servant, still weeping. "Baba, too soon, and bad, like a snake." I was hardly listening, lost in the first moment I brought you to life underground. Your hair set, powder soft on your cheek, and the dress slinking back from your bare arms as you stretch and show me our slippery, mottled child. My solaces, the day's long, self-forgetting work, embarrassed by those sad half-shouts above the punkah whirring, "Can I help you, Saab?" Then evenings drunk, alone, the bedroom shutters drawn, and my shadow reeling to and fro across their slats, folding dresses into tea chests, scooping up the baby things, your belts, a lacy petticoat, shoes, blouses from the cupboard. So much of you to find. 3 nights, but always something overlooked, and then a fourth, and rain. Almost home, I was head down through the yard and stifling when it broke. A long-drawn, sizzling rip like linen tearing, then a pause, and then the first big drops, distinct and smashed in puffing spurts of dust. Monsoon again. That night, I stretched across our bed and drank among your last unsorted clothes, the house lights all turned off. No sleep, but blankness interrupted suddenly to find the rain had quickened, thunder cannoning above my roof, the eucalyptus shimmering and thrashed, its whole enormous height smoking in a constant crash. Then blankness swimming back, the rain dissolving, and a dream releasing me beyond my room my garden, bobbing on a grey race of water to your grave. I scrambled deep beside you and was dry, tugging at your clothes, whispering, let go. Give me these for laundry. Let them go. How many days? 2, 3. I let myself sink from the world, half sleeping or dreaming awake, with the rain a steady hissing downpour, seething to rot me through. When I first stood outside in the glittering yard, it was morning. A week? More since you died? Nobody said. It was all, come here, Saab, come quick. And someone splashing ahead to the compound gates. There. They waved one arm, its arc sweeping the whole slope. Ganga. I thought of your grave buried deep underwater, and with it the whole plain to my feet. Fields and dusty tracks lost in a dimpled yellow-green lake where bloated cattle were drifting twice their size. Gable ends jutted from froth, and the trees had grown astonishing packages, carpets rolled and strung above water, their dark sacks a roost for files of sodden, ridiculous birds. Now sit, Saab. Sit here. It was the holy man, patting the veranda floor. Good. His face caked white, and crouching body draped in a leopard skin. A circus strong man, reading my life. Saab, you are an educated man. Don't be afraid. I am educated too. Hazlitt, the beautiful late poets. You are lonely. Eyes closed, and the greasy ropes of hair, one hand pressing down on his wire cage and its parrot, a brilliant green hat feather tail. You are lonely now. His mesmerized voice pausing, collecting itself. You must go. Your work here, finished. The factory, finished. His head leant sideways, and then, no more. Almost a shout. These are your own thoughts. He was gone, a faltering stoop prance down to the yard, dragging one leopard's foot in the dust. Did I dream it? Lying before me were grains of wheat, a twig, a charred, thick chapati. My life out of my hands. By autumn, 2, perhaps 3 carpets a week, never enough. When I drove out, the weavers' houses were empty, ruinous shells, looms unstrung, and everyone working all day in the fields, shoveling grey Ganges silt into banks, scraping and patting their ditches. They will come back to us. That was Pradeep, swirling his drink as our final December AGM dragged on. He frowned. But when? They must care for their land. Then a shrug, and a blank stare outside to the compound walls and still eucalyptus trees. We shall see. Yes, we shall see. We spoke without thinking, leaving the date of our sail still vague as the evening darkened. And well, said Pradeep, relieved and embarrassed. Well, we must finish. Time we should change. For the party, he meant. Mirsapur Christmas dance at the club. By 10, I was there, drunk, and hearing the ink spots, bless you for being an angel, bless you for making a new world, just when the old world crumbled so helplessly. The record again and again, like a commonplace tender grief for that sweltering room with its swathes of tinsel and ivy, its yellow billiard cloths, and its walls dotted with cotton wool glued there by servants who had never seen snow. I woke at 5 to a bare house, luggage already halfway home. My last morning, a delicate stripe of sky strengthening under my door, and the chokidar's shadowy steps backwards and forwards, his cough, and the phlegm with its soft scatter. When I looked out, he was gone. A charpoy tipped to the wall, and a torn-off toothbrush stick thrown on the balcony steps. Saab! A voice, loud in the hall. The driver's come. I was bowed in the cold yard as the servants draped their garlands on, roses and ganders, a necklace of sweet-smelling, tickling loops. Goodbye, Saab. Goodbye, goodbye. I salaamed to the puckered faces, not daring to speak, and was blind through the compound gates and on for a mile, two, of the dusty lane until I leant forward. Stop, wait for me, wait, and I knelt at your grave. Then the memory blurs. I can follow my tentative hand to your stone, touching as if it were braille. Beloved wife, fair child, but the images shift, and here I am, almost asleep at the window again, smearing a hole in its misted, silvery glass. There are footsteps now, your father's crossing the landing. He calls to me, 7 o'clock, and clumps downstairs. I watch a whining milk float clatter house by house down the street, and daylight begin. The sun is no more than a thin, whitening slit, the sea, a bleak horizon, returning to grey.